Thank you, and good evening, everybody. I'd like to talk to you, first of all, about my wife, Nicole. She spent the first part of her life scared stiff of getting cancer. Her mother died of cancer, her father died of cancer, grandmothers, aunts and uncles, they all died of cancer. She thought that any day it would be her turn next. That is, until one day, just 15 years ago. That was when she met me. And then she learned that cancer is an optional disease. You can choose not to have it. Or if you've already got it, you can stack the deck of cards in your favor so that you will make the best chances of recovery. What causes cancer? Somebody give me an idea. What do you think causes cancer? Stress? An idea? Anybody else give an idea?
Nutritional deficiencies.
Nutritional deficiencies, gene mutations, pesticides. Well, they're all kind of good ideas. I'm surprised nobody's mentioned smoking and nobody's mentioned sunshine, for example, because those are often the thought to be the causes of cancer. But in reality, none of them are the causes of cancer because we're all of us. Well, many of us are exposed to these things, and they don't always generate a cancer. For example, the Japanese smoke a lot, but they don't tend to die of lung cancer, for example. No, I like to look at it this way. And in fact, the oncologists will say they look at it this way. That we've all of us got precancerous cells inside us. We're even born with precancerous cells. Just in the few minutes I've been talking to you, one or two cells have gone precancerous in my body. So why is it we're not breaking out into tumors? Over the eons, our bodies have built defenses. 10 or 12 lines of defense, which, you're quite right, is called the immune system. And so if a cancer breaks out, it means there's been a failure of the immune system. That's what a cancer is. It's a failed immune system. Now, under normal circumstances, back as nature intended, cancers would never actually get to the point where they become tumors. But the way we live today is creating breaches in those defenses, such that they do break out. And a lot of it is what we're going to be talking about a little later on. I'm going to show you a couple of slides. See if we can get this right. There we go. This is the rate of breast cancer. American women died in 1960, four times the rate as Japanese women of breast cancer. And I chose 1960 because the Japanese were still living their traditional kind of lifestyle. And the Americans had already started on the modern Western lifestyle. But even worse, we get this thing to go. Oh, there we go. It's a little slow. American men were dying at 20 times the rate of prostate cancer. So let's not kid ourselves. Cancer is a disease of lifestyle. It happens that the Japanese had a better lifestyle back then than the Americans. It wasn't perfect because they're still getting cancers. But nevertheless, it was better. I'm just going to move this chair out of the way. I think somebody thought I might feel a little weak at the knees and need to sit down for a bit. So let's not kid ourselves. It's a lifestyle disease, cancer. So where did it all start to go wrong? What's going on here? Let's talk about some of the major aspects of lifestyle. And I'm going to first of all focus on the kind of nutrition that we put into ourselves. If you go to the zoo, you see signs in front of the cages. They say, please don't feed the animals. Now, you think about that. You feed a gorilla on popcorn, it gets sick and dies. The zookeeper knows there's a particular feeding pattern that is right for each of the species. Even his children know that if you put a cat, a canary, and bird seed in a cage, the cat eats the canary and not the bird seed. And yet the zookeeper will go home, just like most of us do, and think they can feed their children on whatever comes to hand, including cat food, and bird seed. And we now know that this is totally wrong, that there is indeed a feeding pattern that is right for the human species. But to understand what it is, we have to go back to our origins. We have to go back to the place where this body of ours was forged. Now, when I first started talking about this 15 years ago, it was totally new. But we now have a fair, when I was first doing my studies back in the 60s, we had no clue where the human origins were. But now, it's been nailed down. Thanks to the miracle of understanding DNA analysis, we now are sure that every single person in this room, every single person on the planet, is descended from a small group of people who lived just 2,000 generations ago here. That's the yellow oval. Oh, I'm in your way. Let me just tell me, I'll walk out of the way. That's right. That oval, that yellow oval, is the human homeland. It is the savannas of East Africa. It's in the tropics. It's in the Rift Valley. And our ancestors started off life back there. And we are all still tropical creatures. It's not for nothing that we like to take our holidays in the sunshine and the palm trees. An Eskimo is still a tropical creature, just dressed up like an astronaut so that he can live in a terribly inhospitable place. And the vital thing to know, and this is the real breakthrough, is that we've still got the same bodies as back then. We still have the same digestive systems, we still have the same biochemistry, we have the same mentalities for life back then. So what was it like back then? We can kind of conjure up the scenery. We've got the idea of the savannas of East Africa, the rolling grasslands, the occasional trees, the elephants, and so on. Here are some mood pictures. This is a wing bean tree, provides a kind of nut that our ancestors would have been eating tens and hundreds of thousands of years ago. Well, the flamingos, the ostriches, the warthogs, a scene on the savannah, lions killing a herbivore. And this is somebody who still lives in that kind of area. He's a sand bushman. And he's setting a trap. And you know, we used to feel sorry for these guys back there. We wanted to feed them up on corned beef and condensed milk. We couldn't understand how it was that they had good eyesight, good teeth, and lived in good shape to the end without the benefit of doctors, dentists, and all the paraphernalia of medical support. And it was only later that we came to realize that we were the ones looking down the wrong end of the telescope, that he is living the way nature intended, and that we were the ones leading artificial lives, and the mismatch was making us sick. So how did our ancestors live back then? Because this is the key to the question. Well, they lived in groups of 40 to 50 people, 9 or 10 families, and they would have a territory of about 200 square miles within which they wandered. And just to give you an idea, the whole of the area, whole of the London area within the M25 is about 1,100 square miles. So that area, back in Pleistocene times, would only be able to support some 5 forager bands, some 200, 250 people. Now it contains 8 million, 10 million. They would camp for a certain length of time in one particular place, and then they would move on 5, 10 miles, 15 miles to the next camping site, stay there for a little while, and then move on to the next one. Round and round it went throughout the seasons, throughout the millennia, throughout the eons. And at that time, they basically, their biology, their mental systems were basically in equilibrium, a dynamic equilibrium with their environment. Every morning, the women would go off in the group with the young children on their back up to about 4 years old, and they would go off foraging. And after 4 or 5 hours, having walked 3 or 4 miles, they would come back carrying some 15 to 20 pounds, 7 or 8 kilos of foraged food. 4 or 5 times a week, the men, like that sand bushman, would go off seeing what they could do. And they would do set traps like that sand bushman. They might scavenge for what was left of the zebra after the lion had finished with it. Or they might indeed try and trap one of those warthogs or chase after a flamingo. And when the men came back with what they found, because it was always animal matter they came back with, that's all they're interested in. It was a kind of trophy food. I haven't got time to go into that at the moment. It's kind of trophy food, but they ate everything. The people that they brought it back, the family would eat everything, the brain, the blood, the guts, the whole lot. Meanwhile, the women would have come back carrying mostly plant food, but also some animal matter. Now, the plant food, I'm deliberately using vague terms, by the way, because you wouldn't recognize any of this in the supermarket. The plant food was mainly the kind of things we might imagine. It was leaves and nuts and berries, some underground tubers and so on, and fruits. But the fruits were rather different to what we know today. They were much less sweet and much less watery, and that makes a difference, and we'll come on to that a little later. And they also brought back animal matter. The women would be bringing back things that it would be easy to get with your bare hands, which didn't move too much. So, yes, eggs, ostrich eggs, flamingo eggs, all kinds of eggs, whichever they happened to find, have always been part of the human diet, are absolutely right, and they were much prized. Shellfish from the borders of the lakes and the rivers, they would be eating shellfish. So far, so good. They would also be catching lizards and little snakes, and they would be catching caterpillars and little bugs and grubs and bringing those back too. And I stopped right there because I did have one woman go away from one of my lectures, and she said, the guy's crazy. He's telling us to eat frogs and snails and puppy dogs' tails. Well, I'm not saying that, although the French, and my wife is French, do come pretty close. But what I'm saying is that this gives us a profile, a nutritional profile, which is the one that our body expects to receive. And if we can emulate that in today's world, then we will be putting the right kind of gas in the tank, as I say to my American audiences. And the good news is, it is perfectly feasible without having to do anything particularly exotic. But we just have to know how to navigate.